Slide and oh, there we go. The question we're going to begin with is this one. How do you feel about the terrifying, avenging God of the Old Testament? Richard Dawkins, every Christian's favorite atheist, because he gives such brilliant quotes, he described the God of the Old Testament as the most unpleasant character in all fiction. But it's not just opponents of Christianity, folk like Richard Dawkins, who take this stance and feel this. I guess all of us feel the force of this sometimes. You know, we're positive about Christianity, probably, if we're in this room. But we sometimes have our own issues or questions about how God reveals himself. Mark Twain famously quipped. Is that slide again? Brilliant. All fixed. Mark Twain put it this way. It ain't those parts of the Bible that I can't understand that bother me. It's the parts that I do understand. And perhaps that's how you feel today. Today, I think we are considering one of those passages, Old Testament passages, where we worry about the God who's revealed here. And our passage describes, it contains a title for God. Well, he's not just described as terrifying and avenging, which he is. He's actually celebrated as such in our passage. And if you look with me, our passage contains a title for God. It's in verse 42 and then again in verse 53. And it's a title for God which comes only in this passage. And in our translations, God is described as, verse 42, the fear of Isaac. Or some translations go for the awesome one of Isaac, in the sense, you know, awesome in its traditional meaning, one who inspires awe or fear or dread. You could translate it the terrifying one. And that's how that's the title we get for him twice in this passage. But as we get into the passage today, what I hope we're going to see is that, yes, God is rightly described as terrifying. In fact, he's going to be an avenger, one who seeks vengeance, as we're going to see. But what I'm going to show, hopefully, is that these are not aspects of who God is that we're to be uneasy about or embarrassed about. These are actually things for us to celebrate. These are things to praise God for. And we've got 3 points there on your sheets. They're also on the screens. The terrifying Lord can be trusted to protect his people because he totally humiliates his rivals. And so we can rest assured. And that's where we're heading. And we're going to start with point one. The terrifying Lord can be trusted to protect his people. So let's get into the passage. Our passage begins in verse 17, and it's got Jacob making his move to escape. If you've been with us in this series, you'll know Jacob has been living under forced labor for 20 years. He's been repeatedly tricked. He's been oppressed by his father-in-law, Laban. And now at last, he makes his move. Verse 19. Look at verse 19. Laban had gone to shear his sheep. And Rachel stole her father's household gods. That we're going to come back to the stealing of the household gods later. And verse 20, Jacob tricked Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him that he intended to flee. So here we have Jacob, and he's like one of those inmates you see in a prison break drama. He's been biding his time. He's been watching the movements of the guards. He's been calculating all this time, when is the best moment to make my escape? And he's worked out that the annual sheep shearing time is definitely the moment to act. You see, sheep shearing time, everyone's away from home. Everyone's working very hard morning till night. And so Jacob, he thinks, I can definitely get a head start on them before anyone even notices I'm gone, and I can plan my escape. And he's right. He gets a 3-day head start. But then verse 22, when it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsman with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. Now, for those who are interested in the geography, and we love a good map at Grace Church, I know you all love the maps. This is where we are. It's a visual of Paddan Aram, which is where they've been staying. That's where Jacob is escaping from, Laban's place. And Canaan, down in the middle, is where he's heading to. That's the promised land. And Gilead, most of the way to Canaan, is where Laban is about to catch Jacob up and pounce on his prey. So that's what's going on. I've mentioned before that this account in Genesis is written in a way where there's obvious parallels that we're meant to notice between Jacob's experience here in Genesis and Israel's experience later, hundreds of years later, in Egypt. And we had some of that in our kids' talk today. And I'm just going to lay out some of the parallels so that you can see there's meant to be echoes between these passages. For example, Jacob finds himself in a foreign land up in Paddan Aram, just as later Israel finds themselves in Egypt at the beginning of the book of Exodus. Or, here's another one, the oppressor, who is Laban, he refuses to let Jacob leave because he's too useful to him, just as Pharaoh, many years later, refuses to let the Israelites go for the same reason. And there's this oppression. But despite the oppression, God multiplies his people. If you're here with us for chapter 30, he gave Jacob 12 children. And we see it later with the multiplication of the Israelites down in Egypt. And they get thousands and thousands of descendants. Then, as we saw last week, Jacob, like Moses later on, he approaches his master and he asks if we can leave, me and my family. But Laban, he's just like Pharaoh, and he says no. And that's why Jacob ended up staying another 6 years where he was. And eventually God does intervene and he enables his people to return on this journey to the promised land. We saw the beginnings of this last week with Jacob. And you get to see it in the book of Exodus with the Israelites. And so off they go with great plunder, great possessions. Jacob takes his flocks and herds. Israel goes off, do you remember, with the Egyptians, gold and silver. But, of course, the tyrant is angry and he pursues after them. So I'm putting this all out here. If you were an Israelite reader, this is, as you read this, you would notice these echoes. And you think, oh, these stories are very similar. And we're going to actually add more to this table as we go. But the reason this background is helpful is it helps us see how a first reader would be reading this chapter. And they're thinking at this stage, oh no, Jacob, he's about to get attacked by his oppressor, who's a bit like Pharaoh in the story, and who has this, you know, greater military might. And we're thinking, what's going to happen to poor Jacob? And we actually hear about the superior military might in verse 29. Laban says, it is in my power to do you harm. So it really is a moment of jeopardy, of real danger for Jacob. What's going to happen to him? And so here we are in a story. We're terrified. We're on the run. And into this situation, wonderfully, the Lord intervenes. Look at verse 24. But God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night, and he said to him, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. And apparently the sense of this phrase is something like, this is how the Good News Bible puts it, be careful not to threaten Jacob in any way. And here we get the first clue as to why it is that God is referred to in this passage as the fear of Isaac. Here we're seeing that God is presenting himself as the intimidator. God, the intimidator. It's a little bit like, and forgive me if you think this is irreverent, but in the Batman Begins film, Batman in that film, he's interrogating, he's threatening one of the real bad guys in Gotham, one of the murderous crime lords who's terrorizing Gotham streets. And when Batman has this conversation with him, he decides to hang him upside down over a five-story drop just for the conversation. It's just to make clear that Batman means business and he will not be happy if he harms the people of Gotham. He just wants to make his point clear. And it's not a perfect parallel. Forgive me if you think that's irreverent. But I think there's something of that kind of dynamic going on here. God is deliberately intimidating Laban. And he's doing it for a reason. He wants to protect Jacob. And it works. In verse 29, when Laban does finally catch up with him, with Jacob, and he wants to have it out with him, Laban says, it is in my power to do you harm, Jacob, but, and what is the but? You know, why didn't he crush him? What's the thing that held Laban back from doing damage? But, This is verse 29. The God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, good or bad. So God the intimidator, he's got pretty robust tactics. He even threatens people. But these tactics are actually very effective. And it is the Lord's threat to Laban which ends up protecting Jacob. And then in verse 42, we discover not simply that God's intimidation tactics are effective, but we discover that everything God does is acting out of compassion for Jacob. In verse 42, Jacob confirms that the reason the Lord rebuked Laban was because God saw my affliction, Jacob says, and the labor of my hands. He's saying that God has seen the way Jacob has been oppressed over these last 20 years, and that his rebuke, this intimidation of Laban, was to put things right, to protect his dearly loved child, Jacob. And that's why in the heading, do you remember, I put the terrifying Lord. This is God the intimidator. He is the one who can be trusted to protect his people. Because it's only because this is what God is like. God is a God who is prepared to step in. He's a God who gets his sleeves rolled up and gets involved. And it's because he's this kind of God that we as his people can trust that he really will do what he said. He will keep his promises and ultimately bring justice and protection for his people. I'm guessing quite a few of us have seen this film. It's the film Avatar. It's actually the highest grossing film of all time. I'm imagining quite a lot of us have seen it. And it's set on the planet Pandora. And it's amongst these colorful Na'vi people. And the deity of the Na'vi is the goddess Eowa. And in the film, there's a moment where there's a big military invasion against the Na'vi. And the hero, who's called Jake Sully, he asks whether just maybe the goddess Eowa could help defend them in the battle. And then he's told this: Eowa does not take sides. Her role is to protect the balance of life. And you hear that and you think, oh, well, fat God, a lot of good she is. You know, when you're actually in a problem and you're about to get crushed by an invading army, you know, she's useless. Thankfully, the true God is not like Eowa at all. The true God really does take sides, and he intervenes and he protects those who have been wronged, and he avenges where there's been injustice. And he does this obviously partially within history, like he does in this passage. And he promises that he will do it fully and finally at the end of history. Every wrong will be righted on that day. And that, can I say, is the best news you could hear. A God who actually cares and who will put things right. One of the best loved quotes from the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe book. It's where Lucy is discovering about Aslan the lion, who, as you know, represents Jesus in these books. And Lucy's worried by the idea that this character is a lion. And so she asks, is he safe? And you'll remember, safe, said Mr. Beaver. Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. And then as the story unfolds in Narnia, and we discover about the, you know, the terrible situation they're in. Everyone is enslaved by a white witch. We then realize just what wonderful news it is that Aslan is this strong and formidable warrior. And he really does take sides and he fights for justice in that book. You see, whether we are comforted by this discovery that God is a terror to his enemies depends for you and me, I think, on what kind of a God you think we live, what kind of a world you think we live in. Do you think that we live in Peppa Pig world? Do you know what I mean? Where everyone is always lovely, there's always laughter. The worst thing that can happen, what is the worst thing that can happen in Peppa Pig world? I think it's that your pet tortoise might get stuck up a tree, which obviously doesn't happen anyway, but that's the kind of peril that could happen. If you live in that kind of world, then of course an Aslan or a Batman in, you know, or a true God is not going to be any help to you. But if we live in the world we actually live in, where there is real sin, real injustice, real oppression, can I suggest that you might feel quite differently about the God of the Old Testament, the true God? Because here is a God who actually steps in and terrifies his enemies and who avenges wrongs. And that is the God who we can celebrate and whom we need. Incidentally, as we consider, I began the service asking how we feel about this God of the Old Testament, this terrifying avenger. In some ways, that's kind of the wrong question, because how you and I feel about him isn't really the key question. And it's worth being aware of how dangerous it is to pick and choose which parts of God's character you and I approve of and which parts we trim and edit out. Do we only read nice, comforting passages? Do we find a church which only preaches nice, uplifting messages? Because the Bible has a word for people who make bespoke designer gods who fit their preferences. And that word, you'll know, is an idolater. We trim God to be the way we want him to be. And if we go down that line, we will ultimately get exactly what we deserve. We will end up with a homemade God, a God who fits us perfectly, but who is absolutely useless to anyone because he's a made-up God. You see, unless we are committed to letting the Bible reveal who God is, even when on those occasions we feel it might be offensive or unpalatable in our culture, and incidentally, you know, which aspects of God's character we object to will change from culture to culture across the years anyway, so it's a very subjective opinion. But if we do that, we will always be prone to worshipping a different Jesus and a different God. So can I encourage you, when you get to those parts of the Bible that are, you know, you find make you sit up and you find it difficult, lean in. Those are the parts of the Bible, unsettling as they are, which are going to do you a lot of good. Because unless your God is able to surprise you and unsettle you and contradict you sometimes, as the true God does and will, there is a very high chance that we are settling just for a designer God of our own making. So lean into those parts of the Bible. Okay, that was a little warning about idolatry. But back to the passage. And if you've been following the drama of the passage, it's kind of got a double tension to it, I suggest. So the first tension we've already seen, it was the fear mounting as Laban was going after and chasing Jacob. But then that tension got released by God appearing in a dream and intimidating Laban. But then the passage has another drama to it, a second tension. And this time it's a tension created by Rachel and Jacob and by their foolhardy, and I would suggest foolish, behavior. One of the things that really upset Laban is the fact that, and we learnt this in verse 19, Rachel chose to steal her father's household gods, his idols, that he had trusted in to protect him, and which I guess he used for guidance and divination, which we saw last week. And so Laban confronts Jacob in verse 30, and he says, "Why? Why did you steal my gods?" Now, we don't know exactly why Rachel stole them. Perhaps she's hedging a bet. Perhaps she thinks, you know, I will trust the Lord, but I'll also keep trusting my previous gods as well, and I need them with me just in case, perhaps. Or perhaps she's just angry with her dad, understandably, because of the way he's treated her, and she wants to get back at him, and she knows this will wind him up. But whatever the reasons are, Jacob is unaware of what she's done. And then Jacob adds his foolishness to hers when he makes this declaration to Laban in verse 32. Look at 32. "Anyone with whom you find your gods, Laban, shall not live." We're reading the passage and we go, "No, Jacob, you idiot. Did you accidentally just sign your wife's death warrant? What a thing to say." And we're worrying what's going to happen. And the narrator knows how to build the tension. The search party gets released and they get closer and closer to the gods, the idols. Verse 33, "So Laban went into Jacob's tent." No, they're not there. Oh, we're okay. "And then into Leah's tent." Oh, no, they're not there. That's okay. "And then into the tent of the two female servants, but he did not find them." Good, we're okay. "And he went out of Leah's tent," you know, the narrative is slowing down, and he entered Rachel's tent. And our heart sinks. Oh no, he's in Rachel's tent. She's going to get her comeuppance now. And then the tension gets relieved. Verse 34. Now Rachel had taken the household gods out of her tent and had put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban felt all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, verse 35, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me. So an idiom saying, I'm on my period. So he searched, but he did not find the household gods. And, you know, we're still not resolved, but we think, you know, at least we've got this far. Now, as it happens, it's Rachel's clever trick which ends up saving the day. I don't think we're necessarily meant to defend Rachel's behavior in this chapter, either the stealing or the lying to cover it. But I think this episode is included in the chapter to teach us a very different and very vital point. And that is point two. Yes, the terrifying Lord can be trusted to protect his people because, point two, he totally humiliates his rivals. So let me show you that. I think to a first reader, verse 35 is meant to be comic. It's meant to be hilarious. It's a joke, really, at Laban's expense in the first sense. You know, Laban, who has tricked Jacob so many times, is now getting a taste of his own medicine. He's being tricked. And there's a terrible awkwardness to this situation, isn't there? Probably, I'm guessing here, a woman in Laban's situation would have probably checked under the saddle anyway, wouldn't she? But Laban, like most men, and that, you know, the narrative is making fun of men at this point, they're too shy, wouldn't dream of trying. And therefore, Laban ends up looking very stupid at the end of it. All this bluster, and then he has to climb down because he doesn't find anything. But especially, this is a joke, not just at Laban's expense, but also at the idol's expense. The whole point of having these household gods was for protection, to protect Laban and to protect him from stuff getting nicked. And these little godlets can't even defend themselves from being stolen. And we're meant to think they're ridiculous. That, you know, what puny gods? And some of you know, as soon as I say puny gods, what's coming next. It reminds me of one of my favorite clips in the Marvel Avengers movie. And I've mentioned this before in a sermon once. Where Loki, who's the baddie, he proudly declares, enough! You are all of you beneath me. I am a god! And you kind of know where it's going to go then, because at that moment, Hulk steps in and he grabs Loki by the legs and he slams him around like a rag doll. And Hulk leaves him lying on the floor and then delivers the immortal line. You're well versed in MCU. Puny god. And off Hulk walks. And that is the kind of joke that is going on in this passage here. The gods of Laban are so puny. They can't even stop themselves being stolen. And worse than that, they're effectively being used as a sanitary towel. To an Israelite reader, they would hear all of this through the filter of Leviticus 15. Everything a menstruating woman comes into contact with becomes unclean in that culture. So these so-called gods are not just defeated, they are utterly soiled and humiliated. And the point for us is that it's very easy for us to get intimidated by the great powers out there in the world, the great gods of this age. You know, the things that we're worried to get on the wrong side of. We'll get cancelled. We live in fear of being cancelled. And whatever we fear, we then end up trusting in. Think of the things the people around us most value, the things we fear being on the wrong side of, the gods of beauty. You know, I have to look this way. The gods of success. I have to achieve this grade. The gods of reputation. I cannot get cancelled. And we look at these gods, and to be honest, we are tempted to give these gods the same reverence, the same fear that everyone else does. We must obey. We must obey, and we bow down. But there's a great tradition in the Bible of just making fun of these silly idols. I think in the Bible of Elijah and how he makes fun of the prophets of Baal in 1 Kings 18 where's your God now? Has he gone to the loo? Elijah says. Or think of Isaiah making fun of the gods of Babylon in Isaiah 44. You know, do these Babylonians really cut down a tree and use one half of the tree for firewood and the other half they bow down to it? And that's just crazy. What ridiculous gods. And the Bible keeps reminding us that these things which everyone else fears, everyone else puts their trust in these gods. And the Bible says, no, they're a joke. They're not going to save you. They're not going to protect you. In fact, you should look on them as about as impressive as a soiled sanitary towel under a camel's saddle. They are just ridiculous, these alternative gods. It's a little bit like the Boggarts in Harry Potter. Do you remember the Boggarts? They are the shape-shifting creatures, and they take the form of whatever the person fears the most. And so what should you do if you meet a Boggart? Well, you say ridiculous, and you make fun of it, and you laugh at it. This is where Neville Longbottom, he was terrified of this guy called Snape. And so what did he do? Well, he imagined Snape wearing his grandmother's clothes, and then the Boggart loses its power because everyone laughs at it. And this passage encourages us to consider all those things which the world fears, which we're tempted to fear, and now imagine them wearing Granny's bonnet, or imagine them, you know, soiled under a camel's saddle, and we say, ridiculous. Do not fear them. Do not worship them. They are laughable. And the upshot of all this is point three. That means that you and I can rest assured. In the final verses of our chapter, Laban knows he's been beaten. And so he says in verse 44, come now, let us make a covenant, you and I, Jacob and Laban. Then Laban and Jacob, they create a non-aggression pact. And the idea is that verse 52, if either one of them passes over the territory marker to attack the other side, they call on their respective gods to judge them in that context. So from this point on, it's a great point in the story of Jacob. From this point on, Jacob can now relax. He's not going to have to go to bed every night just wondering, you know, is this the night when Laban finally catches up with me and kills me in my sleep? No, that whole Laban chapter of his life, that whole period of slavery and hostility, it's done, it's dusted, it's settled, it's behind him. And he can now carry on the rest of his journey in safety without always needing, you know, to look back over his shoulder as if his attacker's going to get him. And so wonderfully in this episode, the Lord enables Jacob to triumph over his oppressor without Jacob even having to lift a sword. And the Lord does it through neutralizing Jacob's enemy and through humiliating the rival gods. I mentioned at the start, do you remember all those parallels? Parallels between Jacob's experience and Israel's experience in the Exodus. And actually, God humiliating his rivals here is another parallel. It's very similar to the humiliation of Pharaoh's gods, which Samuel was telling us about in the children's slot. It all happened during the Exodus plagues. And then the final parallel in this passage is how God eliminates all future threats and brings peace and rest. And you'll remember that God did that in the Exodus as well through drowning the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. And after that point, the Israelites can relax. They don't have to wake up every day. They don't have to go to bed every night thinking, is this the night Pharaoh cuts my throat in my sleep? They know it's settled and they have peace and assurance. And of course, this whole rescue paradigm, and you see it in Jacob's life, you see it in Israel's experience as well. The whole point of it in the Bible is to teach us about the much greater rescue to come, which we now experience in the Lord Jesus Christ. This is actually something which the apostles really delighted in the New Testament. And it's crucial to understanding just what it is that Christ has achieved for us. I wonder what it is that you think about when you think about the cross of Jesus. We're going to take bread and wine a bit later on. And what are you going to think about as you eat the bread and wine? Sometimes we think about how God liberated slaves. It was redemption from sin and judgment. But as we think about that, remember that it's also about God the Intimidator taking on and conquering the great enemy, cursing the snakes, crushing his enemy. And of course, you can't liberate slaves, can you, without defeating the oppressor, without taking out Pharaoh. That is the perspective we get, for example, in Hebrews 2, where we read this. It's talking about Christ, and it says, Christ shared in their humanity, so he became a human being at Christmas, so that by his death, he might destroy him who holds the power of death. That is the devil. This is saying, what did the cross achieve? You might give all kinds of answers to that. Don't forget, it's also a crushing of an enemy. We really do have an enemy. He really is too powerful for us. The enemy is powerful in his accusations. You know, he tells us that we don't deserve God's favor, and he's right at one level. Or he's powerful in his lies. He successfully deceives the nations and tells them that God is not for them. And at the cross, this Lord, the terrifying Lord, the Intimidator, he avenges and defeats his great enemy. And he cancels the accusations. They're gone. And he exposes the lies about God. We never need doubt God again. And not only does Jesus beat his enemies, he also utterly humiliates them. Sometimes if you're a sports watcher, you'll know that a sports star is so much better than their rivals. They don't just beat them, they own them. They humiliate them. I don't know what your sport is, but this would be folk like Michael Jordan or Cristiano Ronaldo, or folk like Mike Tyson or Caitlin Clark. And they don't just beat their opponents, they leave them. You see, they're completely humiliated on the floor, looking very, very stupid. And this is how the Message Bible describes what Jesus achieved on the cross. This is Colossians 2. It says this: Christ stripped all the spiritual tyrants in the universe of their sham authority at the cross, and he marched them naked through the streets. The ESV, which is the translation in front of you, puts it, he made a public spectacle of them. He didn't just beat them, he owned them. He humiliated them. Is that how you and I think about what happened on the cross? The cross has so many beautiful facets to it. Yes, it's a demonstration of God's love, wonderful love. Yes, it's a demonstration of God's wisdom. But wonderfully, as we look at the cross, we need to understand it is also a demonstration of God's utter destruction and humiliation of all who stand opposed to him, especially the great enemy. That is why you and I do not need to fear the world around us that is opposed to God. This world, the great enemy, it has all been humiliated, it has been owned, and is now ridiculous. Ridiculous. So before we dismiss terrifying avenging God of the Old Testament, perhaps that's how you started thinking, you know, I can't get on board with that God. Can I ask whether you actually think that maybe we live in Peppa Pig world then? But if you acknowledge that we live in a real world with real sin and real enemies, can I suggest that we have every reason not to be embarrassed by, but actually to celebrate our terrifying warrior God? And of course, this is the whole reason why we can rest assured. We can have assurance before God. We don't need to fear death. When those doubts, when those insecurities creep in, we just tell them to get lost, because we have this God. We have a terrifying, intimidator God who is for us, and therefore no one can be against us. This is the God we worship. And we're going to celebrate in bread and wine, all of these things in a bit. But before that, and before our prayers, we're going to have a moment's quiet. And I'll encourage you to come in the quiet before God, the terrifying avenger God, and to praise him for who he is in all his power and wrath. And let's have a moment's quiet before we have our prayers.